Now, from time to time on this programme, particularly around this time of the year, we like to delve into the richness that is here in the RTE archives. You know, that gives you a hint of Irish life, as it were, then and now. And today, we're delighted to be doing that with one of Ireland's best-known comedy actors. You will know her best as Winnie McGugan. She is, of course, Eilish O'Carroll. Are you Eilish or Eilish?
Eilish.
Eilish, OK. Mm-hmm. Good afternoon and welcome,
good afternoon.
Eilish. Just to reflect, obviously, the success of Mrs. Brown's voice.
Yeah.
Incredible, isn't
it? It's incredible. I still pinch myself, Marion. Yeah. It seems like it's happening to somebody else. And I really mean that. I feel so detached from it. And when people go, God, my God, it's such a phenomenal success. And it is, yeah.
Yeah. I don't mean any violence here, but you beat the Queen one year.
I know we did.
On Christmas Day.
And I reckon if Dermot had got married last year instead of in previous years, we probably would have beat the Queen this year. It's just amazing. It's an amazing success story and nobody ever expected it to happen.
Right. And you're still enjoying it.
I love every minute of it. I can't tell you.
But you don't watch it.
I don't watch myself. That's very hard. And I think that's quite common with actors. I find it difficult to watch myself. I can watch the old episodes now, the ones that went out, say, 6 years ago.
Right.
Because I'm so separated from it now, I can actually watch it and enjoy it and I don't criticise it.
Right. Okay, now, you are going to be our first to kick off on this. I suppose I should say to you, no, we'll start with Frankie. You're going to start with Frankie. Tell me about Frankie.
Dear Frankie. Well, I grew up in a household where the radio was always on in the background. And Dear Frankie would come on and she would actually start off a debate in the house once she'd finished because she was so, and it's in retrospect, looking back on it, you know, she was so pro-men and telling women, she had a great ability to tell women how they should behave to keep their husband happy. There was no question. She never went, you know, oh, you sound a very unhappy lady. She never did anything like
that.
She always came out with a solution immediately. And it was always, if you do this now, and if you be a good wife and you put on a nice smile and have your dress, you know, a clean dress on when he comes in and his dinner on the table, you will live happily ever after. That's my memory of Dear Frankie.
Okay. Well, we have a little listen.
Dear Frankie, my boyfriend, he insists that we go Dutch. His argument is that in this day and age, it would be offensive for a man to pay the girl's share, since it would imply superiority in him, and also a sort of menial status in the girl. Yours sincerely. I'm sure it goes down splendidly at intellectual gatherings, especially if there are a lot of women present. But where personal relationships are concerned, I think there's something about the fact that a man pays for a girl's cinema ticket which brings out the best in a man. It gives him a pleasant preview of the joys of providing. And later on he'll find out that it's not so easy. Equality of sexes may be fine, but until the girl finds it easy to propose marriage to a man without the excuse of leap year, don't rely on it too heavily.
It's amazing, isn't it?
I mean, it's just, it's laughable. It really is laughable. You know, that women unfortunately didn't feel and didn't have the right, really, to actually pay her own way because that's what she wanted to do.
It's the whole ethos of the thing. It's like the Donna Reed show,
yes,
which was a Neanderthal show,
yep,
in America, you know.
Yeah.
Put on your makeup and have a nice new dress, preferably.
Absolutely, new dress and a big smile on your face. And let's not talk about how unhappy you are.
Right.
And what your needs are. They're really, really not important. It is very much how he has to be kept happy.
And how did that go down in your household?
Well, that would have been a very difficult... my mother would have probably been hitting her head against the wall, but she would have actually found it extremely funny. The boys, however, because I had five brothers, and at that time, all my sisters had emigrated. So I had five brothers, and they're, you know, if they were there in the house and this discussion would take place, they were, you know, oh no, they're very macho, you know. And I mean, no, this is the way it should be. And a woman should do as she's told, and she should realise how
Did
lucky
Brendan
she is.
Brendan O'Carroll say that
no,
to his
I think
sister.
Brendan was a little bit too young, right? Right? And if he'd have said that in front of my mother, it was, you know, he'd been put to bed. But so it did, it was always very funny. I always remember it being quite funny afterwards, and when we would debate whatever she had issue she had actually addressed.
Right.
So, you know, but it was a great opportunity actually for my brothers to learn, right, from my mother and from me, that, you know, you can't have that attitude towards women. It's not right. You're going to have to buck up your ideas. It's,
right.
You know.
I was going to say it sounds like the last century, but of course it was the last century.
It wasn't. That's the tragedy. You know, I mean, I know times have changed, but I often wonder, have people's attitudes really changed that much?
Right. So she actually performed a social welfare role in your family by getting the debate going.
Yes, she was a socialist at heart. There was no doubt about that.
Your mother was.
My mother was.
But I'm saying Frankie generated.
Oh, she did actually. I mean, you know, I mean, there was some very positive stuff that came out of that from our perspective, because we had some very healthy debates,
right?
And we had such great fun as well. But in that, we were learning. Both of us, you know, all of us were learning about people's attitudes and challenging our belief system. So, yeah, we should be really grateful to Frankie for a lot of things.
The other thing, she was a great woman for Frank Sinatra. Anyway, listen, I'm going to have to pause us there because I'm going to have to break for the Angelus and the news, and we'll be back after that. And so, to the Angelus. As you know, I am here in the company of the woman whose programme beat the Queen's speech, Eilish O'Carroll. Eilish, you referred to your mother there when we were talking and how she would react to what Frankie had to say. She was ahead of her time.
She was, yeah. She was.
Tell us a little bit about her.
Okay, she was a very well-educated woman. And her father was the greatest influence on her, and she grew up believing that she could be anything she wanted to be. The reality was she couldn't, right? But despite this, and despite the fact that she had 10 children, she went out and she was the first female Labour TD to be elected in Ireland in 1954. And, you know, it was something she was very, very passionate about. She was very passionate about social change for women and particularly for children. Yeah. However, this didn't necessarily go down very well with her family or her peers, because the attitude then, as you can well imagine, was mothers should be at home looking after their husband and their children. And so, you know, be barefoot and pregnant and be happy that you...
So how did she manage it?
I don't know. She was married to a wonderful man who was also a man born before his time, who had no issue about donning his apron, washing us, bathing us, cooking us, cleaning for us, sewing for us. And I'm not exaggerating about that. And also there were four older sisters as well. So, and I think the bulk of the responsibility did actually fall on them to look after the smaller children. So, you know, it did have a personal cost to my mother and to the family. But I think it was a cost worth paying.
Did she, do you know?
You know, I'd love if she'd lived long enough for me to have these conversations, because, you know, life's wonderful when you can look at something in retrospect.
Yeah.
I do remember coming home from school and my mother not being there. I don't have early memories of my mother, i.e. as a very young child. But the fact is, she wasn't there to have them. So, of course, you grow up with a little bit of resentment. But then we're living in a society where the woman gets blamed for everything anyway. Yeah. Right? So, you know, I don't know any different. So there's a little bit of resentment on my part towards my mother. Why weren't you there? As there would have been for the rest of us.
And did you ever have a chance to talk to her?
I did. I was very, very lucky in so much as when I was in my early teens, I was the only girl at home. And my mother had changed considerably in so much as she was a widow then at that time. And we became very good friends. And I know my older sisters find this hard to believe, but we really did. We spoke as woman to woman. So she shared an awful lot with me about her earlier life, about why she became a nun, why she left, why she got married, what her aspirations were, that she would have one child, she'd go back to teaching. Your daddy would start up a nice little business on his own because he was a brilliant cabinet maker with no ambition, but she'd enough ambition for both of them. She had her whole life planned out. But she didn't realise that, you know, she had no control over how many children she had. And I spoke to her about this and I said, but you were an educated woman. She said, education has nothing to do. She said, you can be extremely educated and extremely ignorant. And I was very ignorant. We didn't have the resources. We didn't have the information. We didn't have the knowledge. And she said the guilt that one would feel in stopping having children was enormous. She said it didn't even enter my head.
Interesting, isn't it?
Isn't that very interesting? And I mean, you know, I've often said she was overeducated. And that sounds awful, but she admitted herself that her education had been her curse.
Why?
Because she wasn't able to go out and do what she wanted to do. What she got was opposition. What she got was judgment. What she got was, she said, and I think that's what she meant by that.
All right.
That it wasn't applauded. It wasn't encouraged. It wasn't respected. It wasn't acknowledged. So, you know, all these, this woman's wonderful dreams and ambitions were at a time
frustrated
when...
Frustrated her.
Yeah, totally frustrated her. Right. Totally frustrated.
Yeah.
But despite that, Marion, she still continued to go on. She still did it.
Right, you're going to write a play about her.
I am in the process. I've started it. And I really want to tell this woman's story because it's not unique in so much as there were other women in history who, you know, achieved an awful lot. And we're standing in a country today and living in a country today because of those women.
Yeah, without
because of
a doubt.
Those changes those women brought. And I feel we haven't heard their stories.
Right. Okay, well, a woman whose story we did hear, and I still remember it as if it were yesterday, because I was at part of the hearings for it. And this is what you have chosen. Well, you've chosen women today, which is an old pal of mine.
Yes.
But this is with Hilary Orpin. Now,
right.
Tell me what you've chosen and why you chose it.
Why I chose women today?
And the Kerry babies.
The Kerry babies. I think I chose it because I, on reflection, I remember my own reaction at the time was one of judgment. Now, I'm not going to apologise for that. I suffered from the same conditioning as everybody else. And I thought, how could a mother do this to her child? However, as the story unfolded and as it as it went on, I was horrified and ashamed at what was happening to this woman, how she was treated, how even after she was cleared of this particular crime, and then continued on to go into a tribunal where she was, her life was under a microscope. I just found the whole thing horrific.
Okay. Well, now we have a clip, and it was from Women Today. It's a clip from 1986. Hilary Orpin talking to Margaret Egan of Kerry's support group about their indignation over what they see as bad treatment of Joanne Hayes.
Well, as you probably heard on the news, the tribunal does continue today with a demonstration of support for Joanne Hayes outside the hearing. First, let's go to Tralee to hear from a member of the women's group there. Margaret Egan, what's the situation like in Kerry at the moment?
The general feeling that we have been getting since the tribunal started has been people getting more and more upset, and especially women becoming more outraged, really, at the line of questioning being pursued at the tribunal. And the sort of intimate detail that's been gone into into the personal life of Joanna Hayes. Mm-hmm. How far is it permissible for people to go in degrading and distressing a witness in order to arrive at what they believe to be the truth? And the thing is that we have to keep reminding ourselves that Joanna Hayes is a witness at this tribunal. She's not on trial. She seemed to be up there on a sort of pedestal, and she was surrounded by this sort of crescent, all male. It's like jury, sort of, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why a lot of women have started to go down to the courthouse or to the town hall now, where it is, to show her that, you know, she wasn't alone and that other women were behind her and were really feeling for her.
I'll never forget it, actually, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting she was saying there that she was a witness.
Yeah. No, she wasn't. She was on trial. And my memory tells me that that tribunal was to invest...
Remind people what happened. Sorry. There was a baby found...
There was a baby found on a beach in Carhartsravine, I think it was. And the baby had been stabbed to death. A newborn babe. A woman, coincidentally, miles away, has given birth to a baby. And she has turned up to a hospital to say that she had a miscarriage. It turns out that they discovered that she had actually gone full term. Anyway, she told the police after she was... This is Joanne Hayes. She's a suspect. She told the police that she had given birth to a baby, that the baby had died, and that she had told nobody about the baby, and she had left the baby in a field on the farm. Now, that's how I remember the story. Now, what happened... Once she revealed that was a nightmare for society, that the police were allowed. She was, first of all, they discovered very quickly that the baby in on the beach was not hers, couldn't be hers because of the blood group. But they then came back with, oh, she possibly gave birth to twins from two different fathers. Right. Now, you see, they were painting her immediately as a woman with loose morals. That was the kind of the attitude. So, you know, she's capable of anything. And I just found it really disturbing that we as a society, probably powerless because of the time again, couldn't stop that in its tracks and go, sorry. The tribunal was to investigate why the police forced confessions out of the family, which were totally untrue.
Well, the police would say they didn't force, but there was a question left completely unanswered, which is, why did all the members of that family say and sign a confession
that they had killed a baby? Am I right?
It was over in Carhartsravine.
Yeah.
And that which they had thrown the baby. Which was 70 kilometres away.
Yeah. So... You know, and that's what I thought the tribunal was about. But it didn't turn out to be that at all. It turned out that they got another opportunity to question this, interrogate, question was too nice a word to use, to actually interrogate, humiliate, and really take this woman's human rights away. I mean, it was a crime against all women in Ireland, as far as I was concerned.
But did you think that at the time?
As it went on, yes. As it went on, I was feeling very strong. Yeah. I mean, I did. It challenged my own belief system, right? Because, and I realised then, why am I so judgmental? And in fact, it was after that that I actually parted company with the church. Based on that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. It was an extraordinary spectacle, and she was so upset. And she was taken out and given tranquilizers and brought back in and gone out again, questioning in all these ways. Now, it has to be said that eventually the family withdrew those confessions. But tell me about you parting with the church. Was that not because of your own life?
Oh, yes. I mean, at my own, during that time, I was going through a divorce. And thankfully, I was living in the UK, because if I was living in Ireland, it wasn't never going to happen. So it had an awful lot to do with my own life as well. But I knew that if I had lived in Ireland then, I was going to be judged. No
Tell
one was really going to ask.
You had two husbands.
I had two husbands, right. And my first husband, I was married for 8 years, and it wasn't a pleasant marriage, and it was quite a violent marriage. Again, you don't tell anybody these things. Why? Because you feel ashamed. Why should I feel ashamed? You know, it's ironic, isn't it? Why should I feel the shame?
Right.
So I felt the shame. I felt I couldn't tell family or friends this is happening to me. So you don't. You keep very, very quiet because you're afraid you're going to be judged. You're afraid you're not going to be believed. So there was a huge amount going on that I'm looking at this and reading about this case and going, they're not believing her. So And I was able to personalise that because although I hadn't told my own story, I knew that was the reason I hadn't told my own story, because I'm not going to be believed. So it was a combination of good Catholic Christian Ireland can do this to a woman who should have had support, love, care and counselling. Right?
Right.
And that's what I needed at that time in my life.
So what did you do?
I didn't get either. I eventually did manage to get divorced. I did go to a counsellor. I did have help to get me through. And it was the best thing I ever did. Right? And it was non-judgmental. It was to help me come out of a bad marriage.
Right.
And survive and do it.
And you had two young children.
And I had two very young children, 2-year-old and a 6-year-old at the time.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to do.
Very hard. I was really tough. And of course, you're in a situation where it's not uncommon again. You have no money. You have no power. You're being controlled on financial levels, emotional levels and psychological levels. So you don't know how, and I can't run away. Who's going to take me in with two small kids? Couldn't go home, right? The shame of it. So I was stuck in this kind of bubble. But I did go out and I did get outside help and it was there.
Right.
But I didn't know where to go for it. It was really a difficult one for me to find, but I did find it.
Right.
And I did get the support that I needed.
And then you found your second husband.
And then I found my second husband, who was and still is a lovely man. I mean, an absolute adorable human being who made a wonderful stepfather from the point of view that their own father had disappeared. They just did his disappearing. So he had no interest or no influence in the children upbringing at all. So I needed a father. I didn't just need a partner. I needed a man who was going to take on my children 100%. And I have to say he did 150%.
There you go. Right.
I was a very, very lucky woman. And he was also a very lucky man. I have to say to myself,
yeah,
it was a good trade. I was good.
Right. Okay. And you say he reminded you of your father.
He did, because, you know, my father was would do anything for the children. And he didn't feel less of a man because he had the apron on and he was sweeping the floor.
Yeah.
And my second husband was exactly the same. He was a better cook than I was. He preferred to do the shopping because I always spent too much money. Right. So he preferred to do the shopping. So it was very much a relationship of equals.
Right.
And that was lovely. And that had been my you know, picture of growing up.
Yeah.
My mother and father had that. So I thought all marriages are going to be like this.
Right. Yeah.
And all marriages are not like that. But yes, I was very fortunate. And we worked. And what we could do, Marion, was we could really talk to each other. That I think, was the most important part of our relationship, our communication. We
right.
talked about everything.
Right. So then what happened?
So then what happens? I came up to my 40s and I was searching for the meaning of life, as we all are round about that age. What's it all about? Where am I going? Why am I here? Blah, blah, blah. And I went off on a spiritual quest, let's say, and I joined, no, I didn't join, I went on a course, a second aid, it was called. I won't go into the details of it, but it was really kind of finding yourself on a spiritual level as well as on a physical level. And I met a woman there, and the very short story is I fell in love with this woman completely and utterly over time. Wasn't instant. I'm talking over a period of time, 2 years. And she became a very, very good friend. And I realised after several months that I felt a little bit more than a friend towards this woman. And my whole life, my whole being just went into a spiral because I could not cope with it. I couldn't understand it.
Because you were homophobic.
Totally. Of course I was. But I didn't know I was until I'm faced with it. Of course, how could I be anything other than all the messages that I had received all my grown up? I didn't even hear the word homosexuality. It was never even mentioned in her household. So obviously I was aware of it when I got older and I went in, but I'd never met anybody who was gay. I'd never spoken to, I didn't know what they were supposed to look like. But I wasn't going to be one. How could I possibly be one? I mean, that's abnormal. And I'm even using that term. Words like that. It's abnormal. It's abhorrent. It's sinful. It's all of those things. So I threw myself into quite a spiral, and a mental spiral. She didn't know how I felt about her. And the only person I could talk to was my husband.
That's extraordinary.
Isn't that extraordinary? And, yeah. And I remember him being extremely supportive. Wanted to help, didn't know how he could help. Suggested I go and see a counsellor, which I did. And he said, maybe it's just a phase.
Yeah.
But the one thing he did say about to me is that you have nothing. You have nothing to feel ashamed about.
What a guy.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about the shame, but I mean, he was looking at the end of his marriage.
Oh, absolutely. Of course he was. And he was, so I just thought... But he hadn't. He was English. He'd been brought up. He didn't believe in anything. You know, when you live, you live. When you die, you die.
Right.
And he said, it's what you do with your life that's important. He was probably more Christian and than I could ever be, without, you know, and be totally agnostic as
right.
well.
Right. Yeah.
You know, he always believed that you treat your neighbour as you should treat yourself. You are good to people. Where you can be good, you are good.
Right. Well, as I say, what a guy. So, you ups and leaves him.
I ups and leaves him, yeah. I upped.
And your kids.
Yeah. Kids, don't say it like that. They were, yeah, in my head, they were babies. They were actually, one was in his 20s and the other was coming up for 20. So in my head, they were little babies when I left. I just felt I owed it. I couldn't stay because the feelings I had for her undermined the feelings I had for him. That's how I felt.
Right.
And
you used to go back many days a week.
Oh, yes, I used to go back. I mean, guilt. I used to go back in to do the housework. I only moved around the corner. Rented a room around the corner and came in every day and did a little bit of housework. And as I remember my son coming in one day and the plug from the Hoover just stopped. And I turned around and he said, Mum, you can't Hoover up your guilt. I thought,
wow,
powerful words, but true. And that's what I was trying to do, to ease, you know.
Oh, he wasn't getting at you?
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh, really?
Oh, I don't think so. I think he's saying, look at what you're doing. You can't do that. You can't, you know, stop doing this. We don't need you to do this. I needed to do it.
So skipping on and on and on and on and on.
Yes.
You moved to West Cork.
I did.
You were now going to be very prosperous in your 40s because of Mrs. Brown's boys.
Yes.
So a lot of things were changing. And I'm just looking at you, the picture of elegance as you came in the door. You decided to go for the boots and the short.
Oh, I ran away to West Cork. I mean, Brendan was very good to me then. He had spoken to me on the phone and I'd always talked about coming home to Ireland. We had talked about coming home and retiring in Ireland, myself and my husband. And I said, look, I'm coming back. And he said, well, you need a job. You come and work for me and we're travelling all over Ireland. You can decide where you want to live. And that's exactly what happened. So I always, when I speak about it in my own show, I always say, I ran away with the circus.
Right.
And it was a safe place because no one asked you any questions.
Yeah.
Right. So that's what, and that's when I started growing. I suppose I didn't really, prosperity didn't actually come until my 50s.
All right.
Right. So we were still doing it because I'd get about 5 or 6, maybe 14 weeks work from Brendan a year.
Right.
And we were playing in little theatres and, sometimes making money, sometimes not making money.
Right,
so,
yeah.
So, yeah, and that was... So the journey, really, coming back to Ireland, although one would say a mad thing to do when you want to... If you're coming out in Ireland, it turned out to be the best thing because I think this is where my demons were born.
And I needed to come back. Rid of them.
And I had to face them. And coming back to Ireland, I faced them and eventually had the courage to say to myself, I have nothing to be ashamed of. I am who I am and I'm proud of it and I'm going to start living my life.
Right.
And that was the day I started living. And not just on my sexuality level, that growing up was on so many different levels. And the sexuality was such a small part of it at the end of the day.
Interesting. But I was very amused that when you went to West Cork, you joined a group.
Yes.
And you went for the stereotype kind of caricature thing.
Oh, honestly. I mean, when I think about it, I joined this group in Cork and I thought, well, I'd never seen a lesbian before in my life. I hadn't. And I thought, I didn't know what they looked like, but I'm assuming they're going to have all sorts of, you know, tattoos and short hair. And so I had my hair cut short. I donned the check shirt and the jeans and the bother boots, right? And I even started rolling my own cigarettes, badly now, mind you. But I thought, that is a real lesbian. That is the image I need to portray. How wrong could I be? But, you know, again, we all have these perceptions,
yeah,
don't we?
Yeah.
And preconceived notions of what somebody is and how they dress. We're so wrong. We should never, as my mother, Lord Rester, would say, never, ever judge a book by its cover.
Right. Yeah. Listen, we could go on that theme for quite a long time, but I have to get to number three, which is a soap.
Oh, yes. Yes. The one I remember most is Kennedy's of Castle Ross. And it was a lunchtime show. And I wouldn't catch it every day. I'd catch it when I came home from school. And again, the radio was always on. So it was, and I think now it was set. It was set in a shop. I'm nearly certain it was set in a shop. And then, you know, you'd hear the different episodes. And if you missed one, you'd come in and I'd say to my mother or my auntie, who I used to go to lunch for when I was at school in St. Cabo's, and say, oh, so what happened? What happened yesterday? So, but I couldn't tell you anything about it now.
Yeah, Cass, yes. Isn't it? But you do remember Harbour Hotel.
Yes.
And that was the one that followed that.
I thought they ran around the same time.
Did they?
But I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah.
Harbour Hotel now was set in a hotel, and it was, I remember the main character, she inherited the hotel.
All right.
Right.
Handy
I remember the very
enough.
First, you're handy enough,
yeah.
From an old aunt or something.
Yeah.
And I think that was kind of in the very first episode, which was very early, That was early. That was in the 50s, I think.
Listen.
I can't remember.
Let's have it. Listen. Oh, this was in 1979. That sounds very... Okay, let's have a listen.
I suppose the hotel's been my baby substitute. Without it, learning all I have from Mrs. Doyle, I don't think we'd have been as happy as we have most of the time.
Why do you think I gave up trying to get you to stay home? I could see you needed the job, that it did you good to be working with Catherine.
I've never stopped being grateful to you for that.
I tell you what, I'll even make the cocoa afterwards tonight.
I must be in a bad way. You actually volunteering out of turn?
Ah, just an old sweetheart.
I know how much.
I just want you to know I won't fight you if you decide to have your way with me tonight.
Won't you now? Oh, aren't you one of the kindest people I've ever met?
Oh, sure, what can I do? I mean, I wouldn't have the heart to turn you down. Can't be selfish with myself.
My poor pet.
That was Harbour Hotel, was it?
Yeah.
Very raunchy. Very raunchy.
Very risque. A caller was on to say, what a refreshing and honest interview with the wonderful Eilish O'Carroll. She's given a voice to so many silent women who also feel shame and guilt and are still trapped by their perceptions of society. Another one said, Eilish O'Carroll's mum was one of only two TDs who queried or objected to adoptions the United States in the 1950s. The other was Tom O'Higgins. Isn't that very interesting?
Yeah, no, it is really interesting.
Yeah. The Mrs. O'Carroll showed outstanding moral conviction in questioning the institutional norms relating to forced adoption in her time in the Dáil. Another one says, great interview with Eilish O'Carroll. One clarification, good Catholic Christian Ireland supported Joanne Hayes. It's always the hierarchy who failed to show compassion, and that comes from Eileen in Limerick. Now, Eileen, we could argue that up and down the highways and byways, there was a lot of support, and people were shocked and kind of repelled, I remember, by the way she was questioned. Witness my foot, you know. But there was still an awful lot of criticism, and you thought, mm-hmm. you know, what a hussy.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, that was my initial response.
Yes.
Now, okay, it changed for me. But I mean, I have to be honest about exactly what, when it was first broadcast, I thought, oh my God, how could a woman do that to her child? That's where I came from.
Yeah.
And the more different stories that were coming out, you know, they were adding to it, you know, she already had a child. So you're building up this negative picture.
Yeah.
Right, or they are creating a negative picture for you to actually, you know, absolve, you know.
What had been extraordinary was the thesis or theory that somebody came up with, that she became pregnant with one baby and then very, 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 very quickly after that had sex with somebody else and therefore the DNA would be different.
Can you believe that?
Yeah. She's a very short woman.
Yeah.
So to have... twins. Anyway, I merely mention it.
Yeah.
Ongoing Dutch, this is going back to Frankie. Ongoing Dutch, I'd look on a guy saying that as just plain stingy, looking for a get out clause on paying. This is paying your own way, or going Dutch, as they say. But another one said it was the man who suggested going Dutch, not the woman.
That's
could
right.
have been a sign of progressive attitude. Good or
point.
Just plain stingy.
Well, she's got a point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not all the letters that Frankie dealt with were that frivolous, and she needed to give serious advice. She did. She also battled her own demons. She did indeed.
Yeah.
And thankfully never pontificated about morals. Anyway, listen, I'd love to continue on with you, but we're going to have to leave it there.
That's okay. Listen.
And thank you very much indeed for coming in. It brings people back.
Oh, Marion, it was a joy. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you indeed. We'll take a break.